Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blog and News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for the next 30 minutes. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone in the literary world. My guest today is Kent Whitaker, and I think it would be fair to say that I honestly wish Kent had not had the raw material to write the book, Death by Family. It is based on a true story, and a very, very sad one at that. Good afternoon, Kent, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Simon. Welcome. You have made me welcome. Thank you.
Firstly, let me offer my condolences for your losses, and your losses are many.
Yes, they were, and thank you very much for that.
Perhaps you could give our listeners a quick summary of exactly what happened 5 years ago.
Sure. On the night of December 10th of 2003, my family of four, my wife, Tricia, my older son, Bart, and my younger son, Kevin, and I went out to dinner to celebrate Bart's coming college graduation. And when we returned home, we walked into the house to find a masked gunman waiting for us, who immediately opened fire. My younger son, Kevin, died almost instantly, and my wife within minutes. I was shot in the chest but survived. And Bart, who raced into the house and in an apparent struggle with the gunman, was shot in the arm. We had no idea why. It wasn't till later that evening that I even knew that for sure that Kevin and Tricia had died.
Wow. Now, the story takes a bit of a different twist when the police start investigating.
Yes,
and Bart becomes the prime suspect.
Yes, for all of you parents out there, you can imagine what a horrible nightmare that would be to, in a matter of less than 15 seconds, have your entire life changed, and then within a day or two, we find out that your son not only was not about to graduate from college, as everyone had expected, and he wasn't even in school that semester, but he'd become the number one suspect for having arranged the shootings to hide failures in school. I can't think of a more horrible scenario for a parent. Of course, I didn't believe it, but at the same time, the police were focusing on him, and I knew that there had to be... I wasn't going to totally discount their claims, even though I did not believe it, and I got no corroborating backup for any of it. So I was in the middle, being a law and order kind of guy. I was faced with a horrible dilemma, you know, and I just told the police, I am not going to abandon my son. You may be right. I don't know the truth in this, but I'm not going to abandon him. But at the same time, if I see something or if I hear something, or I will let the police know. So I was kind of in the middle, trying to be neutral as far as my my ultimate stand on this. But at the same time, I was desperately hoping that the police were wrong.
Now, to cut to the chase, the police apparently were not wrong. And Bart now sits on death row in Texas, not a particularly user-friendly state.
No, it's not. Yes, it's a very wide and long story, but he was convicted of having masterminded the shootings, and alone of the three boys that were involved, two of his friends, one drove and one was the actual shooter. He was the only one that they pursued the death penalty on, but both the other guys are in Texas prisons as well, having pled guilty.
I think I'm correct in saying that you were very active and very vocal about not seeking the death penalty.
That's correct, Simon, and I hope that your listeners understand that it wasn't that I was trying to get my son off. It became clear once he was arrested and he confessed to me that he was really responsible for all this. It was obvious that there was something very wrong with him, and my desire was that he would be allowed to spend the rest of his life behind bars. We offered the district attorney two stacked 40-year sentences, which means that he would actually come up for parole, but he wouldn't be, but he would be 106 years old when that happened, the first time that he would ever be up for parole. So he was going to die in prison regardless. But I wanted to save his life because for several reasons. One, there's real question about the chemical cocktail that's being used in Texas as to just really what's happening inside the person who is being executed. Secondly, I wanted to give him an opportunity to do something good for him. If he chose to, in prison, to be a positive influence behind bars, I wanted to give him an opportunity to do that. And death row people really don't. They're segregated. They're locked in their cells 24 hours a day. There's no communal anything. It's very difficult to have communication with the other prisoners. But the main reason I was pursuing this was because, as a Christian, I believe that a relationship with a living God is necessary for an afterlife in heaven. And whether he had chosen to, whether he was truly changed as I believe he has, or not, I can't read his heart, and I just wanted to give him enough time to reach that decision. I mean, I was 40 years old before I made it, and he's going to be dead long before he reaches 40, and I was hoping that the state would allow him to live for if no other reason than to have an opportunity to reach that decision himself if he hadn't already done so.
The appeals process on death row is pretty much it appears to be an automated process. Do you hold out any hope that the sentence will be changed?
I'm hopeful. I'm not overly positive or expecting this to happen, but the process is automatic. If in the state of Texas, if someone is convicted and sentenced to death penalty, then an automatic process goes in, and one group of lawyers makes an appeal to the state claiming that these are the reasons why the things were not done within the four walls of the courtroom correctly. The state reviews that and routinely denies those claims. And then a second group, which is the stronger one, it's a habeas corpus attorneys that go in and argue the states that you're wrong in your conclusions from the first decision, and this is why. Those are routinely also shot down, but once the state denies that, it goes to the federal courts, and there is a little bit more positive hope there. Maybe, I mean, it just depends on the strength of the case, obviously. They're not going to overturn a death penalty lightly. But we're hopeful. There's some things that the legal team is looking at that they feel is got a real possible potential of reversing the conviction to death penalty and converting it to life in prison.
I have to admit that I am not a fan of the death penalty. To me, that is not punishment. Punishment is living your life in a confined space and reflecting on the errors of your ways. But that's just me.
I think that the world is more behind your stance than they are behind the stance in Texas. Again, I'm a law and order guy, and I have had my eyes open to the way the system works. And whereas before, I just really didn't want to, honestly, I'm ashamed to admit this, but I just wanted things to run smoothly. And if someone was going to commit a crime, then they needed to pay the penalty for it. But I have seen just how broken the system is, and I tend to believe that the death sentence is on its way out in America, as well as so America will eventually join most of Europe and most of the rest of the world, actually.
Texas as a state, I believe, has the highest number of executions.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. Sugar Land, where I live and where my son was prosecuted, is in Fort Bend County, which is adjacent to Houston's, the county that Houston is a part of. And so we're all part, I mean, Sugar Land is a bedroom community of Houston. You can't even tell the difference on the freeway coming through. But the point I was going to make is that one out of every 10 convictions and death penalty comes from Houston, the Harris County courts. So one out of 10 in America comes from this one little location. And I think it's like one in four come out of the state of Texas. So it's Texas is preponderance, is much larger percentage-wise than you would expect.
It must have taken a huge, huge amount of soul-searching to pen this book. What motivated you?
Honestly, I fought for 2 years to write Murder by Family. I didn't want to. All I wanted was to become a normal citizen again and go back being invisible. And a book would obviously put me in the forefront of interviews and things like I'm doing right now. I fought that for years. But I became to realize that this story wasn't going away. First, CBS News 48 Hours Mystery, which is a national program in America, did a hour-long segment on the show, and then about a few months later, Oprah Winfrey did a full hour segment on the show, and it just obviously was not ever going to go away. So I had also come to the conclusion that there was a significant need
interest
for forgiveness in our society, and a need for seeing how God does work in horrible situations and how faithful he is if we'll trust him. And so I came to the conclusion that all of these journalings that I've been doing to help me process this grief, maybe they did need to be turned into a book. And so I kind of did a 180 and kind of patched them together, and I found that it was very cleansing for me to go through this and to write it. And I have just been amazed. Simon, the book made it onto the New York Times bestseller list for a little while as a result of the appearance on Oprah. And I have gotten lots and lots of speaking opportunities and letters and emails from people. And it has been amazing to me the nerve that I've touched, because I think everybody in the audience probably has somebody that they need to forgive, even if it's themselves. And sometimes forgiving ourselves for something we've done is the hardest step of all. But regardless, we need to forgive somebody. And we really don't know a lot about forgiveness and how to do it, and we have misunderstandings of what forgiveness really entails, and people back away from it because they have a misunderstanding of what forgiveness really is. And I've been able to speak about that, and I've been able to talk to parents with kids who have problems. It's just been a wonderful emotional healing experience for me.
From reading the book, I came away with the impression that in the aftermath, the weeks that followed, you had a very high level of frustration with the police. You felt they were looking in all the wrong places. although in retrospect you realize they were not.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the question is, should they have confided in you more?
Oh, gosh. Honestly, they probably couldn't have. I wished that there had been some way that they could have. The way it played out, they found out early on some things that I did not know that led them to be convinced that Bart was responsible for arranging the shootings. I thought they were off base. There were two other potential things that could have explained what happened that night that I thought made more sense that they never would explain away. But at the same time, there was a murder investigation going on, and it was very high profile in the area, and they were doing it properly from a police perspective in that they were not tipping their hand at anything because they were watching Bart. They were convinced that he was responsible, and they did not move until they had everything in line. And I think they were afraid that if they'd confided in me with it, something that they had, that I would have told Bart and he would have turned around and run. Well, I wouldn't have, but they didn't know that. And so it was horribly frustrating for me because I didn't believe them. I thought they were going down a wrong trail. They told me no, they knew that Bart was responsible, but they wouldn't give me any evidence, which was why I said, I am not going to abandon my son simply because the police told me to, but I'm also not going to accept his cries of innocence without, a modicum of skepticism. You know, I was just stuck in the middle, and it was a horrible place to be.
Oh, I can imagine. For 7 months, there appeared to be absolutely no movement. Why did they take so long to formulate their case?
Oh, gosh, I don't really know. They had a far stronger case than we knew, but there were some details that they were pursuing in hopes that it would be stronger. I think they were also hoping that Bart would finally break and admit it. That didn't happen. He became afraid that they were about to arrest him, and so after 7 months, he ran off to Mexico. I had no idea where he'd gone. Honestly, didn't even know if he was still alive. I never heard from him during that time. But 15 months later, I had a call in the evening from the lead detective with the Sugar Land Police Department telling me that that Bart had been arrested and would be returned to Fort Bend County for arraignment and trial. And at that point, my life fell apart again.
Wow. I'm curious because you have almost quoted directly out of the book. How was he arrested? Was he arrested by the Mexican authorities? Or?
Oh, gosh. It would be really nice to know all the details about that. The Mexican authorities aren't talking. And he was arrested in Mexico, brought to the border, turned over to I believe it was the FBI who then turned him over to the Sugar Land Police Department representative who drove him back to a 5 or 6 hour drive from the border to Houston and drove him up back home. So I don't really know all the details about it other than it was pretty brutal.
Mm. Long after the event, the warning signs became visible. But
mm-hmm.
as we all know, hindsight is 20/20. You know, my hindsight's wonderful.
Yeah, and the problem with parents, and I suspect if there's anyone out there listening that has raised a kid, it's true. Raising children is a series of mistakes. You do this and you correct it. You do this and you correct it. And you just hope that the kids are learning. If they aren't learning, well, then you pay a little bit more attention to it and you kind of notch up the lessons a little bit. But if they appear to be growing and learning, then you just assume that's part of the growing process and you move on to the next step. But Bart was hiding so much from us, and he was a terribly good liar. very, very, very intelligent, and he was able to keep this mask in place that he was hiding behind, fooling everybody, his fiance, her family, my family, Trish's family, all of his friends. He just was very good at this, and it wasn't a matter of us being foolish or stupid or not ignoring warning signs. In retrospect, there were some warning signs, but they were hidden. And I suppose even if you haven't raised a kid, you can look back on your own life and say, boy, I'm glad Mom and Dad didn't know about this, and realize that everybody has hidden stuff from their parents. And as parents, we probably had our kids hide stuff from us. In my case, it was just fatal. It was just fatal.
Indeed. Clearly, you're a very deeply religious man. And in the book, you state that you've unconditionally forgiven your son. Some might find that a strange decision. You lost your wife, your best friend, and you also lost a son. In fact, you've lost two sons.
I have lost both of them.
What brought you to make that decision?
Well, to start with, I find it strange too. It is beyond human ability to just screw up the courage the force of will and say, well, all right, I forgive everybody on this. You can do that for a little while, but it always comes back. I truly believe that forgiveness comes from work that God does inside our hearts. Now, that's not to say we don't have a component in asking Him to do this. In fact, I think it might be helpful to just kind of talk about four things real quickly that forgiveness is not, so that people can get a little better picture of this. I don't believe that forgiveness actually heals the wound. That is something that God does. What forgiveness does do, though, is it cleans the wound out, which allows God to heal it. When somebody hurts you really badly, there's a horrible wound there. And if you hold on to the desire for revenge or the bitterness, well, it just gets infected, and it can never heal. It'll grow over sometimes, and on the surface it'll appear okay, but down deep inside there's that infection.
Yep.
Yeah, you have to choose to ask God to help you forgive in order for that to get cleaned out and for you to heal. Another thing that forgiveness isn't is forgetting. You know, there's an old saying, you know, forgive and forget. Well, I'm sorry, if somebody hurts you really badly, you're not able to forget, because we only forget what's trivial. And if somebody has really, really damaged you, then that's not trivial, and you can't forget it. Now, God can. He is able to forgive our sins and forget them, but we're not God. And in fact, I don't think it's really a great idea for us to forget, because in this imperfect world we live in, we kind of have to watch, make sure we don't get taken again, and we have to remember something. So it's, if you're able to forget something that's real, I mean, truly forget it, then I think it's probably more a case of being in denial than it is true forgiveness. Now, that's not to say that you go back into the same relationship. If your business partner steals from you, he's responsible for the consequences of his actions, and you can choose to forgive him, which I think is the right thing to do for your own healing. But that doesn't mean you necessarily go back into business with him. See what I'm saying? You know? And one other thing that I think is important is people think that if you forgive somebody, then you're really removing their responsibility for what they did. Well, that's not the case at all. When you forgive someone, it isn't letting them off the hook. And while we know that in this world we see people that get away with stuff all the time, but that's just what happens from the world's point of view. In God's courtroom, everybody pays for the crimes that they commit. And we do them every day, all of us, all the time. But it's his decision. That's why the Bible says, you know, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Well, we need to let him be the judge of that. He has a far better understanding of all the hurts and the consequences for them. He'll take care of it. Either the person who commits the crime will have to pay for that, or it will be transferred. If that person has accepted Christ as their Savior, then Christ will pay for it. But anyway, and it's not a shortcut through grief either. Grief is a process that you go through when something bad happens to you, and there's different rooms, and you have to pass through all of them. But the thing about forgiveness is it helps you pass through them quickly and efficiently, and you don't have to get, you're not stuck there. It allows you to get to the end of the grief process and re-enter life. And I don't know about the rest of you guys, but that's what I wanted. I mean, there wasn't anything I could do about bringing Trisha or Kevin back to life, and there wasn't anything I could do about getting Bart off of death row. But what I wanted was to, when I pass through the process of grief, to get back on the end and be able to enter society and life again and enjoy it. And I can tell you, it's happened. I have been healed to the point where I am now engaged. I have a new life facing me. It doesn't. I'm not forgetting about, you know, Trisha, who I love completely, but she's gone. And I wanted this where I am now, which is an opportunity to rejoin life completely and fully and totally. And forgiveness is the way that you get there.
Let's talk technical book stuff for a moment. I'm guessing this is your first book.
Yes, it is.
The book is incredibly well written. You must have had some great people behind you.
Howard Books did a good job. They're an imprint of Simon & Schuster. But honestly, it's pretty much as I wrote it. I had an editor who went through and helped me with some obvious tense things that were wrong, or there was she pointed out a couple of questions, you know, this doesn't make sense. You need to explain this a little better. But honestly, I was so blessed that they allowed it to stand without going with, you know, having a ghostwriter help me. They liked the way it was, and that was very, very encouraging to me, because I hope to write another one or more someday.
Oh, good. I'm looking forward to them.
Yeah.
Simon & Schuster, now this is a pretty big league operation.
Yeah, they are.
The big boys don't tend to deal with first-time authors. How did you get hooked up with Simon & Schuster?
Oh, just another one of those things that just doesn't make any sense. I went to a writer's conference to learn about writing and learn how you go about making proposals, and I knew nothing about this. I was in the construction business for 31 years.
Right.
But I learned, and I learned how to make the pitches, and one of the editors I spoke to was very much in love with the whole idea of the story. And when the proposals went out to the six editors that were interested, he was the one that got the high bid, and so we went with him. And they were very good about kind of keeping a hands-off approach as long as I met the deadlines that they imposed, which were quite stringent because they were trying to get the book to market as quickly as possible. It was kind of a fast-track sort of thing.
Right.
But I hope that I did my part. I think they were happy with my performance on that. But it was just amazing the way the doors opened. And I think, I didn't want to write this book. I really believe God wanted it written, and he's just opened some doors and created some avenues that I've been able to walk down.
We're going to lose our live listeners in about 30 seconds, but the good news is the entire interview is being recorded, and it will be available on www.bloggernews.net in probably a couple of hours. Going back to this book, I doubt that you wrote the book with money in mind.
But no, I didn't.
How are sales going?
Sales are going well, and your listeners should know that every dollar that is paid in author's royalties is going to charity. So this was not written to to make me rich, even though the book is selling well. I don't have actual numbers. Those are lag behind a lot, but the internet sales have been particularly very, very strong.
I think it's a great book, and personally, I can recommend it to anyone. It's sort of dark reading, but the style that you took in penning it is very much from a novel rather than a factual standpoint. And somehow that takes some of the sting out of the tale.
Mm-hmm. I think it does too. It was very important that the reader would follow the feelings that I was feeling at the time. It was very important to me that I could identify with what was going on, because the surface story is so difficult to identify with. I mean, come on. Your older son murdering his mother and little brother and trying to kill you. This doesn't happen, thankfully, to most people. But I wanted them to understand, because bad things happen to everybody. You fill in the blank. You know, problems at work. You know, divorce. Bad doctor's report. There's bad things that happen to all of us. And the key is, how do you keep your head when the whole world falls down around you? And honestly, I couldn't have done it without my faith. And the book talks about the steps that I went through to keep myself sane. And I think it's just a really great map for traveling through the bad times that everybody faces, even though the details are all different.
I'm curious. When I'm not wearing my reviewer's hat, I'm a news junkie.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that I cannot figure out is how one case garners huge press coverage while a comparable one does not. In this situation, I look back at the Menendez brothers,
right. Yes.
As opposed to the Whitaker case. If you say Menendez to almost anyone, they'll go, "Oh yeah, I know all about that."
Yes.
If you say Whitaker, they don't.
Right.
More recently, there's some great examples. There's a little boy, Adji. He's 6 years old, with the mental capacity of a 2-year-old. He's missing. Almost zip coverage, but Kaylee Anthony, Haley Cummings, they're all over the press. I mean, you can't avoid those cases. What are your thoughts on this?
I'm as befuddled by that as you are. It's almost like it's kind of like the movie The Perfect Storm, where several things just kind of happened and bumped into each other to create a much larger story. I can't explain it. It may have something to do with the timing. For example, the day that we announced that Bart was missing, when he disappeared, was the same day that Chairman Ken Lay of failed Enron Corporation, that's pretty much worldwide news too. He was indicted that same day. If Ken had not been indicted on that day, then without a question, these murders would have been the number one story in the fourth largest city in America, and it may have gone national. Personally, I'm glad it didn't. It would have been horrible. I just don't know how I would have handled, because it was hard enough as it was with the news media camped out in my cul-de-sac waiting for me to come out, and people calling me at 5 in the morning trying to get me to talk to them. It was hard enough, but so I can't answer why some Some take off and some don't.
Looking back, can you think of one defining moment that maybe if you had made a different choice, all of this would not have happened?
Well, actually, there's a possible, two possible ways of looking at this. First of all, there is nothing in Bart's past life that I can look at and say, well, I chose to ignore this. And as a result of me ignoring it or not doing my job as dad, these things happen. There isn't one of those. Trish and I were good parents. We were active in our kids' lives. We did a lot of things together. I mean, Bart and I were distance bicyclists, and he and I together did about 14,000-15,000 miles, and that you spend a lot of time with somebody on the saddle that much. But we were very active, so I can't look back and say that there was one thing that we, or even a couple of things that we just totally chose to ignore, and this is the result. He just was a very good liar in covering up all of these horrible things that were going on inside his heart. But there is one thing that I can say that is absolutely critical, and that was the night of the shootings. I'm lying in the hospital bed trying to decide what am I going to do, because as a Christian, you know, I'm looking at God to help me through these hard times. And there's a verse in particular in the Bible that says that God's going to take everything and work it for good for those who love him and are called to his service. Well, I just thought that was a lie, because Trish and Kevin and I, we were all strong Christians. We believed in God. You know, how could he possibly take these murders and work them for good? I just didn't see how that was possible. And if that wasn't true, well, how can I trust any of it? So that decision of whether to turn my back on my faith and just step out in the human wisdom and vision would have been totally different. Everything would have changed. But instead, I lay there in the hospital bed and said, I have told people for years that faith is an act of willpower. It doesn't have anything to do with our feelings, because our feelings will convince us to make bad mistakes, bad decisions. Faith is what happens when you choose to do what you know God wants you to do, even when it doesn't make sense or you don't want to do it. And I was faced with the granddaddy of all of those. This didn't make sense to me, but God says he's going to work it for good. Do I trust him or not? And it was at that point that I said, I don't know how you're going to do it, God. I truly cannot believe that this is possible. But your word tells me, and I'm going to choose to trust you, even though it doesn't make any sense. And when I did that, he set into motion a series of events that ended up with my son having a breakdown in his heart of this shell that he created around him so well and for so long. It finally broke open, and it would never have happened if I had not chosen to forgive him that night, which was a step or two down from that decision to trust God when it didn't make any sense.
I know that a large number of our listeners want to find out more about this. Do you have a website that they can visit?
Yes, I do. Thank you for mentioning that. It's www.kent, K-E-N-T, and then dash, which is a hyphen, WHITAKER.com. So Kent-Whitaker.com will take you to my website. I don't sell books there, but there are some links there to
the usual suspects.
To the usual suspects. And again, this was a book that was made a pretty big push. So they may I don't know if they'll be in your local bookstore, but most of those that I've gone into in the last half year have had it.
Wow.
That's pretty
Kent, my producer is like waving her arms at me. It's time.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and it's been a pleasure. I just hope that the listeners will take a look at the book, and because there's a lot of very positive things. The story's dark, but it's a very, very positive book in the bottom line.
It is. It's a great book. It is wonderfully written, and it certainly gets my endorsement. Now, okay, maybe I'm not quite as big as the New York Times, but you know, I do
me.
What I can.
Thank you so much, Simon. It's been a pleasure.
This has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon, and I wish you the very best, and I also want dibs on your next book.
Okay, that's a promise.
Goodbye, Ken.
Thank you, Dad.